This is a Thinking Aloud podcast from the BBC, and for more details on our terms of use and much, much more about Thinking Aloud, go to our website at bbc.co.uk. Hello. A man rang the other day and wondered if I'd like my name to go forward for inclusion on a new online application. It's a very, very, very exciting development, he told me. As you may know, the BBC and other radio and television companies are increasingly trying to save money, and they're now about to bring their budgetary constraints to bear upon presenters. Well, you see, this is where I come in, because my new app, he told me, On Air Me and Me, allows any broadcasting company to access my website and book a presenter for a specific task, say, oh, I don't know, 45 minutes presenting You and Yours, half an hour introducing Open Book, or a mere 10-minute job reading a script of A Point of View. Of course, you do, I mean, you lose the individuality, he said, of a Jane Garvey or a Nick Robinson or a Michelle Hussain or a Richard Coles, but look at the advantages, you see. Pick a presenter from On Air Me and Me and you save money and time. They'll be on your broadcasting doorstep in 10 minutes and will only charge you over the odds during busy periods. After all, only recently you abandoned your friendly but somewhat inefficient local minicab for Uber, and only recently you gave up that familiar but expensive hotel in the Lake District for overnight accommodation provided by Airbnb. Time now to show some of those pampered presenters that they too are expendable. Well, my presenter's website might sound a trifle fantastic. But then, whoever imagined a few years ago that around 5 million people would now be paid for work which they'd obtained not from an actual employer or an actual company, but from such online sites as Upwork, Uber and TaskRabbit? Who could have envisaged that around 18.5 million of us in the UK would now be using such sites to find not only taxis, but also builders, plumbers, graphic designers and accountants? Well, this is the revolution, sometimes often called platform capitalism. How does it work? What are its implications for industrial relations, for work satisfaction, for everyday life? Well, those are questions for my three guests today. They're Nick Cernek, who is lecturer in international political economy at City University of London and author of a new book called Platform Capitalism. Ursula Hughes, who's Professor of Labour and Globalisation at the University of Hertfordshire, and Andrew Leishen, who's Professor of Economic Geography at the University of Nottingham. Let's begin with a few basics. I've warned you all that I'm going to be asking some rather banal questions about this, but let's start with some basics. I mean, Nick, I mean, what do we mean by a platform in the first place? Could you tell me and perhaps give me some examples?
Yeah, so I think it's a really good question, and it's partly why I wrote the book in the first place, was a sort of lack of clarity about what exactly is a platform. The definition I sort of come to is that platforms are fundamentally intermediaries, which means that they bring together different groups of people. So we can think about Facebook, for example. It brings together users, it brings together businesses, brings together media companies and advertisers, and it connects all of them together. It enables them to all be connected. Same thing happens with Uber. When we look at that, it's people who are offering ride-sharing services, and it's people who want to use these ride-sharing services. So Uber is a platform that connects these things together, and that's fundamentally what I think platforms are all about.
Andrew, want to add anything to this?
Yeah, one way you can understand platforms is that they're multi-sided markets. They act as intermediaries between two or more counterparties. And these are not new in themselves. So, for example, a stock exchange is a multi-sided market. It puts buyers and sellers in contact with another. A newspaper puts readers and advertisers. Computer games, the consoles, they're multi-sided markets. They put developers in contact with players. Platforms have that, but they also have network effects, and they really actively work on those to generate contacts between the people that are on the platform. And they have a kind of kinetic effect. They have a dynamism of connection, attraction, and flow, and they really are animated in getting people to use the platform.
Let's talk about some of the consequences of that in a moment. But before we get there, Ursula, I mean, this, we often use the term sharing economy about what's going on here. One hears that phrase as well. I mean, that suggests something. altruistic here. I mean, we've been giving some economic examples, but it's not necessarily economic.
Well, there is an awful lot of rather obfuscating discourse about this. It's partly because people are coming from different directions. So you have sort of techno-optimists who talk about peer-to-peer networking and the sharing economy, who really see this as a way of prefiguring a sort of a new way of organising society in which capitalists are not intermediaries, very idealistically. And on the other hand, you have people who see this as a development from practices like global outsourcing, who talk about crowdsourcing or cloud sourcing or workforce on demand. I mean, there are innumerable phrases here which make it very clear that these are a means for employers to pick and choose from a global labour force at the lowest possible price. And somewhere in between these utopian and dystopian ideas is a very complicated and rapidly changing reality.
Rapidly changing. Let's just pause for a moment before we go on to explore the contemporary situation. Just take a little historical turn, if we may, Nick. I mean, how did we get here? In your book, you're pointing to several key moments in history. I think you start with the 1970s.
Yeah, I think to fully get a sense of exactly what's going on, we do need to go back to the 1970s. And this sort of picks up on Ursula's point. In the 1970s, we have this crisis of profitability amongst all the advanced capitalist countries. Businesses are suddenly not making enough money. And what do they do in return? Well, they try and cut costs, and primarily through wage costs. So this is when we start to see the rise of a lot of outsourcing of work. Now, this is a long-term trend that's been going on since the 1970s, and what Uber is doing nowadays is sort of just the hyper-extension of it. It's not something which is radically new. So that is a long-term trend that we've seen for about 40 years now. The second sort of key moment, I think, happens to be the late 90s, when we have the tech boom and the tech bubble that goes on there. What happens at that point is we start to get the emergence of these digital platforms for the first time. So things like Google start emerging, things like Amazon start coming about, and we start seeing these businesses trying to grope towards exactly how are they going to make money from it. And one of the interesting things is that when the tech bubble bursts, suddenly all these companies, their venture capital dries up, stock equity dries up, and suddenly they need to find a source of revenue really rapidly. It's quite interesting that Google's AdWords, its primary source of revenue, emerges a couple months after the boom of the tech bubble bursts. And I think that's not a coincidence.
What would you like to add to that, Ursula, about this development, about how it's come about?
Well, I would use a slightly different periodization from Nick, but that's a detail, really. I think that we had a rather special circumstance in the third quarter of the 20th century because of the Cold War, really, and capital made different sorts of deals with labour and jobs, you know, allowed for jobs that were relatively secure and permanent. And after the Berlin Wall came down in 1989, there was a global workforce to draw from, and concessions didn't have to be made in the same way. And the 90s were also the period when global telecommunications were liberalised. We had the internet. Computers spread rapidly globally. So a global reserve army of information workers was created, really. And the trends that were set in place in the 90s came to fruition, you could say, after the financial crisis of 2007-2008.
Let me just underline one point. We were talking, really, weren't we, after the 2008 crisis, about the sort of difficulty of finding yields, of trying to find some profits and looking for profits anywhere. You want to talk about perhaps the role of venture capital in the way in which platform capitalism received a big boost.
Because I'd also put into Nick's historical analysis, and I agree with Ursula that the 1990s is really important, because then you also get the rise of China as a global force, and that led to a decrease in global labour costs. And you have this period that's been called the Great Moderation, or continuous non-inflationary expansion exponential growth. And what you have is people chasing return on investment because inflation goes down. And so you get these pooling of large amounts of capital, and lots of it goes into venture capital funds. There's a great line in the writer Michael Lewis's book from 1999 on Silicon Valley, where he describes Silicon Valley as an experiment in capitalism with too much capital. And essentially, there's large volumes of money being put into these essentially business experimentations. And as long as they make money from two of their 10 returns, six can break even, two can lose money. And in a sense, it's like an evolutionary experiment with all kinds of different business models.
Just to come back to you, Nick, I mean, a lot of this revolves really around the whole business of data, doesn't it? I mean, the abundance of data. It's almost the new question of how can you make money out of data?
Yeah, and this has been one of the sort of technological changes which has enabled digital platforms over the past decade, which is the sort of widespread use of various sensors, whether it be, you know, the sensors in our cell phone, the sensors in our computer, the fact that increasingly we're doing all of our activities online and that's suddenly a way to record data. So there's been a sort of burst of data that is accessible to us. It's what's often called big data. And what we're effectively seeing now is that platforms are a business model which is designed to capture that data and then make use of it, monetize it in some way in order to generate revenue. And I think that's what's really interesting about platform capitalism is that it is a properly new business model that is trying to take advantage of this sort of 21st century resource.
Okay, do you want to come in here, Steve?
Well, I think that's very interesting. I think it's actually more than one business model, and it's rapidly changing. But what's very, very interesting is that Airbnb and Uber both started in 2010, just after the crisis, using a very clever business model, which was instead of investing heavily, as traditional hotel chains and taxi companies did, in building hotels and buying buildings and buying cars, they had a model where all those costs were externalised onto the worker, and they then, so to speak, took a rent from the use of those things. So the first stage model of these companies tends to be based on taking a rent, whether that's from activities that used to be in the informal economy, you know, like window cleaning or something, or whether it's from things like hotels and taxis. But then as things develop and the competitors come on the market with the same idea and costs are driven down, then they shift to a different model. Because what do we see now? Uber investing in self-driving cars, you know, in Pittsburgh and in California. And so it's capitalism as normal, really, shifting from one business model to another.
Very quick.
Yeah, I guess there are two basic types of business model. There are those that charge a fee. There could even be freemium, where you experience it for free and then you charge a fee and you get a monthly payment. Or they are free, that people can use them voluntarily. But if you do that, there's an adage in the internet: if you're not paying for it, then you're the product, and that links back to the issue of collecting the data on your use.
Okay, that's very good. Okay, well, thank you all for the moment, anyway. London traffic. Well, the driver of the black cab that took me home from central London last Wednesday night had a familiar list of grievances to propel in my direction. Roadwork, cycle lanes, cyclists, Boris Johnson and demos. All of them, he insisted, were designed to make his job increasingly impossible. But his real wrath was reserved for Uber. Not just the manner in which they undercut black cabs or clogged up the roads, but the character of their drivers, who I was told came from all over the place. "You never know," he said, "who's going to turn up? Afghan, Pakistani, whatever." Well, it was such a familiar tirade that I was tempted to fight back, to rather piously suggest that at least Uber drivers displayed a little more ethnic and cultural diversity than the average London cabbie. But then I remembered a fine Guardian piece by Chitra Ramaswamy, which showed that this diversity doesn't always extend to the passengers. And I quote, "A 2016 study in Boston and Seattle found significant evidence of discrimination on taxi-sharing apps. Rides booked for men with black-sounding names were cancelled more than twice as often as for other men. Black people faced notably longer waiting times to get paired with drivers. Women were taken on longer routes." And Chitra Ramaswamy also instanced similar examples on the Airbnb platform, where it's claimed requests for accommodation from guests with African-American-sounding names were 16% less likely to be accepted than those with white-sounding names. Well, it'll be interesting to see if the anti-discrimination policies on the Airbnb and Uber websites remedy what looks like an example of how the brand new sharing economy replicates historical prejudices. Well, that's the sound of one of those city centre demonstrations that so aroused the wrath of my taxi driver. But in this case, the sound and fury is caused by taxi drivers themselves. Those were Italian taxi drivers demanding regulation of services like Uber and protesting that Uber workers enjoy special rights and privileges compared to traditional cabbies. But what is work actually like for those who labour within platform capitalism? Let me turn back to my guests now, Andrew Leishen, Nick Cernik and Ursula Hughes. Nick, you identify various types of platform working. We were talking before about data, but I want to talk a little bit now about how platform capitalism is changing the actual world of work. And I've got here a clip. It's one woman talking about her experience of working for the firm, a firm called TaskRabbit.
I have done reception work. I've made a photo book for a family who just had their second child. I've designed and made a set of football top trump cards. I have wrapped corporate Christmas presents, all sorts of things. My name is Holly Blake. I've got two businesses, and while I'm building those businesses, I also work as a tasker for TaskRabbit to supplement my income.
TaskRabbit launched a couple of years ago in London and has around 1,000 taskers running around the city.
I, as a tasker, have set up my profile with a range of skills and categories of tasks. I can go in at any point. I can change my availability in terms of when I'm available. So should a client go online and post a task which matches with all of those things, I'll show up in their search results. They will then click confirm and I will receive a text message to my phone.
Well, that was a clip from the Radio 4 series Digital Human, which was broadcast back in August 2016. She's sounding pretty contented with her lot, isn't she? She's a middle-class professional. She's only engaged in such online work while setting up her own businesses. How does her experience differ from other workers' experience who are working online?
Well, first of all, I think you have to look at what you're comparing it with. Compared with not having a job at all, then obviously that's wonderful. But compared with having a proper job with paid holidays and a pension, she's probably earning an awful lot less. She's probably spending a huge amount of time which is not paid for, having to sell herself repeatedly online and search for tasks and chase things up, and also can she really be expert at all those things? That's a perhaps a rather heretical question to ask, but we've just done a big survey of crowd workers, and one of the most puzzling things is the way they all claim to be expert at so many different things, and the traditional idea of a specialist occupation seems to be rather breaking down.
What about this idea then? How much is it opening the way for some people and not for others, Andrew?
Well, the taxi example is a good one because there are barriers to entry for that sector, and that's done as a result of history of various cities and authorities that try and calculate the demand for taxis, but also to kind of give a living wage, but also to cover the various tests you need to do on vehicles and so on. But, you know, those are barriers to entry for some people to be able to afford the ticket to do that. Whereas Uber does allow people who may be from these non-traditional backgrounds at least to become a taxi driver. But as we've seen, there's been some pushback even from Uber taxi drivers that, you know, they find it very difficult to make a living under these new conditions because of the fares. So the fares are good deals for the riders. They may not be great deals for the drivers.
It's interesting to speculate how far all this is going. I mean, we can talk about academics as well, can't we? And I was mocking up presenters before, but I mean, academics are quite familiar with this new type of working situation.
Well, absolutely. You could say that this kind of work is an extreme example of something that's happening really right across the labour force, that work is increasingly broken down into separate, discrete tasks, that people are having to be called to work at very short notice using apps, that they are expected to respond to messages outside normal working hours 24/7, that they have to work to performance indicators. This is right across the public sector now. People have these tight performance indicators that they have to meet and bureaucracy that has to be met. And the more it's kind of, the more that that's normalised, the more people think, don't see the problem with the platform economy, if you see what I mean. We have a young generation now who are most people under the age of 35 probably are entering the labour force on conditions which are very similar in one way or another to working for a platform, even if they are not formally working for one.
I just want to come back to this business of profitability a little bit. There's an interesting... I'm just going to use a little extract from your book, if I may, Nick, where you write, Uber, the world's largest taxi company, owns no vehicles, and Airbnb, the largest accommodation provider, owns no property. Yet the key is that they do own the most important asset, the platform of software and data analytics. Lean platforms operate through a hypersource model whereby workers are outsourced, fixed capital is outsourced, maintenance costs are outsourced, and training is outsourced. All that remains is a bare extractive minimum control over the platform that enables a monopoly rent to be gained. Now, we were talking before about how are people making profits? I mean, is Uber profitable? Are Airbnb profitable? How will they become profitable?
Yeah, this is important to sort of distinguish between different types of platforms here. So we do have Google and Amazon and Facebook, which are incredibly good at generating revenue. But with Uber and Airbnb, it's something which is quite different. And their business model is premised upon outsourcing cost as much as possible. So, you know, the cost of insuring a car, the cost of maintenance for a car, the cost of petrol for a car, all these sorts of things are outsourced to the driver. And Uber, for instance, rents from Amazon Web Services. So it rents its cloud computing in order to scale up its business very, very rapidly. Now, the interesting thing is that they're actually not profitable. Uber is apparently profitable in a few cities, but overall, it's not profitable. Until a few months ago, it was losing $1 billion a year in China trying to fight off its unprofitable Chinese competitor. So this doesn't look like a sustainable business model by any means. If I had to make a prediction, I think the sharing economy as we know it today will probably disappear within 5 years.
So you feel that really if they're not able to establish a monopoly, it's not going to be profitable in the sharing economy? Would you go along with that then?
Yeah, I think we've already seen a situation where the large platforms are already dominating their market. But that doesn't mean there aren't new platforms emerging, new businesses emerging. But in one sense, profitability may not be the option, the outcome for them that they're aiming for. As long as they get bought out, that's fine, because the investment in it can still realise a profit. So between 2010 and last year, Google were buying something like 22 companies every year. So that's, you know, almost like one every 2 weeks.
Just to go back, because you were talking about Google being profitable, just a quick question. I mean, why are those sites profitable now? Is it because of the advertising that they can take? Because of the way in which they can target customers?
Yeah, it's almost entirely for advertising. So Google is about 89% of its revenue comes from advertising. Facebook is 96% of its revenue in the last quarter came from advertising. So that's entirely there where their profit comes from is through that.
It's interesting that, I mean, one of the characteristics of this platform economy is that really the entrepreneurs are not taking on many costs themselves at all, are they?
Well, they are and they aren't. I mean, they invest an awful lot in the website design and in the data management and in the infrastructure that enables them to switch money from one country to another and so on. But it seems to me that it's very much what we're seeing is we're in a transitional stage. This is sort of like the Wild West, you know. These companies have gone out and found new territory. They found new fields to capture in the informal economy, in sociality, in art and culture, things that were sort of outside capitalism. They've grabbed them. But you know, people don't just sit back and take it. People react. So we're now in the stage where governments are actively trying to bring them within the scope of existing regulations, and workers are reacting and starting to demand rights and so on. And it will soon be incorporated much more into general sort of business as usual, for companies as usual. But in the process, what's happened is the standards of protection for workers in all those other industries have been lowered, because this has become like the new normal in terms of how work is organised.
mean, do you feel that I'm just wondering? I mean, Nick. I mean, we've talked about like going about profitability, but I mean, do you feel that any possibility of profitability is also going to be reduced if, in fact, there aren't so many workers wandering around looking for sort of any sort of job? It's only going to operate perhaps in those societies where there is unemployment or where there is a shortage of other sorts of jobs.
Well, I think that's partly why we see the rise of these things after 2008, because we see mass unemployment, we see very long-term unemployment as well. You look at the United States, for instance, the amount of people on long-term unemployment is still incredibly high. It's before any higher than any pre-recession sort of levels. So there's a large group of people who are desperate to find some sort of income, and it means that they turn to these sorts of things. Uber, for instance, has already admitted that within London, it got about one-third of its employees from regions with greater than 10% unemployment. So this is, you know, their source of their drivers.
So we would want to say, I mean, if we're talking about these, just about the legal challenges to these, because can we use the word, employers about Uber and Airbnb, or is that not an appropriate word to use?
Well, this is it's very contested at the moment. There have been a series of court cases about Uber, Deliveroo and Pimlico Plumbers are the three most recent ones in this country, but there have been others in other countries. And the sort of key question really is to what extent there's a relationship of subordination between the employer and the worker, you know, who's telling who what to do.
I mean, with at the moment they say they're not employers because they, how do they, if you like, claim that they are not employers in a traditional sense?
Well, they claim that the workers are independent contractors or freelancers or whatever. But then you have to, if somebody's a genuine freelancer, you have to sort of apply some tests of how autonomous are they, who tells them what to do, who fixes the price. And, of course, practices vary from one platform to another. But as Nick was saying, if people are really desperate, they'll take work on any terms at all.
But you were almost hinting at before, mightn't we say that there are people now? I mean, we're not talking about ourselves. I mean, in many ways, I mean, I'm not lumping you all together with me, but to a certain extent, we've led lives in which there have been careers with steps and with promotions and with moves forward. I mean, if there are people out there now, almost what you could say with a different type of work consciousness, which relishes this type of work, which relishes the freedoms which are provided.
Well, some might if they are successful, but you know, not many may be called, but few may be chosen in this to be successful. You'd have to have a kind of special set of skills and a degree of resilience to be able to work these kinds of things by contracting. Not everyone would be able to do this, and there is a race to the bottom on some of these things, because on things like Upwork, for example, which is a contracting network, they're contracting people from all around the world, and they will undercut for certain kinds of skills. So some people will not, and they will hold out for higher rates, but that's a big competitive force.
Let me have a last word from all of you on the future of platform capitalism. Then, if I was to come back in sort of 5-10 years' time, and you're sitting around me in the studio, and I'm asking how's it going, what sort of state is it going to be in? Are we going to see its development into all sorts of other areas, you know, sites for presenters and so on? I mean, how would you, Ursula, characterise the future?
Well, I think, digitisation has now pervades all industries and sectors. And I think we're wherever we work and whatever work we do, we're going to, in the future, be managed via online platforms in one way or another. But I think one of the interesting that's happened is that different groups of workers historically, they're always insiders and outsiders. And if there's a change, the outsiders benefit and the insiders lose. And the boundaries between inside and outside are shifting very, very dramatically.
Just got time. Very quick word, Nick?
Yeah, very quickly. I think companies like Google and Facebook are only going to become bigger and more powerful. But I think companies like Uber are either going to go bankrupt or they're going to move into a different model, which is something premised upon owning assets.
I think one thing we haven't said is why one of the reasons they're so popular is because people like using them. They do draw people in, and there's an economy of affect and enthusiasm about these that, you know, we need to take into account.
And there we must stop. My thanks to you, Andrew, to Andrew Leishen, and to Nick, and of course, and to Ursula Hughes here. Next week, why might people choose to take off all their clothes and run naked across a cricket pitch? Further proof, if anywhere needed, of the eclecticism of the social sciences.
Thanks for listening. There's more new research from universities across Britain from Radio 3's Free Thinking team. You'll find a project investigating chickens in the Anthropocene, the travels of Richard Hakluyt, how copyright wars affected the books we read, and whether Victorian jokes are still funny. all available as free Arts and Ideas downloads.